This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
Today I'm with Professor Ignaz Schnellen from the University of Leiden. Hi, Ignaz.
Hello.
So you've come to Manchester today and you've given a talk about exoplanets. So for starters, for our listeners, could you maybe give us a little bit of an overview of the current state of research on exoplanets and things like how we observe them today?
Yeah. So exoplanets, first of all, are planets that orbit other stars than the sun. So in general, it's very difficult to actually observe them because they are at such large distances. That's one thing. And then the second thing is that most exoplanets do not radiate any light, mm-hmm. so they're much fainter than their host star. So we most of the time we can't directly see planets. We have to use indirect method, mm-hmm. and one way, a very successful way to actually do that is using the Doppler shifts of planets, and maybe to try to explain that in simple terms.
Yeah, sure.
Is so a planet moves, of orbits an actual star, and it goes around the star because basically gravity from the star pulls on the actual planet.
Yep.
But basically gravity works in two ways. Also, the star is a little bit pulled towards the actual planet. And because of that, the star wobbles a little bit.
Okay.
And that wobbling we can measure because we can very accurately measure the actual velocity of the star. And with that, we can then derive by measuring the nicely varying velocity of the star, we can induce the presence of an actual planet.
Okay.
So that's one way, and then the second way, and that's also the way which we use a lot in Leiden for our studies, and that is, if you're lucky, then seen from the Earth, a planet moves in front of a star, and in that way it blocks off a little bit of starlight, and it temporarily dims starlight, mm-hmm. and these little dips you can actually observe, and in that way also induce a planet.
So I think that's the technique behind some of these space telescopes, including Kepler, which we've mentioned a few times on the Jodcast, which is looking for exoplanets.
Yeah.
So thanks to something like Kepler, we've now seen all sorts of different exoplanet systems. Is there any are there any common characteristics between different types of exoplanets?
Well, actually, what Kepler has shown us is that the variety is so enormous of exoplanets. If you look at the planets within our own solar system, now you could argue that we more or less understand how planets are formed. You have the rocky planets at closer distance to the sun. They have the gas giants like Jupiter, which are further away. And we thought that we understood why that was, mm-hmm. and that is, you have to think about how planets form. There's a disk of gas and dust under its gravity. Planets form and they attract more and more matter. And if they are heavy enough, then they start to also attract a lot of gas. And then you build a gas giant.
Sure.
So what Kepler has found, there's actually an enormous population of planets which are in between the rocky planets that we know in our solar system and the gas giants. So a bit of super Earth or sub Neptune, mm-hmm. Mass, which also in density is a little bit in between the high density rocky planets and the very low density gas giants. And we have no idea what they're chemical buildup is. For example, these could be water worlds, or they could be rocky cores with large gaseous halos around them. So it's very, very interesting.
Okay. And can you, is it possible to characterize the exoplanets more than, say, just their mass or just their orbit period, that sort of thing?
Yeah. So what, for example, Kepler gives us, so when you take a transit measurement, you can measure the size of the planet. And if you now also measure this Doppler wobble, mm-hmm. then you can get the mass. So then you have a mass, a size, and you get an average density. So okay. Then you can already start to say something about the composition. A rocky planet would have a high density, a gas giant, a low density. But But it's also interesting, if you take transit measurements, you can also learn something about the atmosphere. And that is when the planet moves in front of the star, a little bit of starlight filters through the atmosphere. And that leaves planet atmospheric absorption, for example, absorption from molecular gases.
Mm-hmm.
And you can measure that by taking very accurate spectra, taking the actual colors, measuring the colors.
Yeah, how the light changes. With frequency. Sure. Yeah. So obviously this seems like quite a difficult thing to do, and it seems natural to want to use a space telescope to do it. But in your talk today, you also suggested that you can do this very well with ground-based telescopes, despite the problems encountered, such as the Earth's atmosphere and that sort of thing.
Yeah, so the first observations now been taken a bit more than a decade ago. We're all from space, for example, with the Hubble Space Telescope, and then some very nice observations with the Spitzer Space Telescope. And people thought in general, yeah, the Earth's atmosphere is going to be such a problem. It's really not possible to actually do this from the ground. But it turns out that actually, if you use the much larger telescopes we have on the ground, if you use them in the right way, mm-hmm. then you can actually still do these very accurate measurements from the ground as well.
Okay.
And it's a very tiny signal. So we're talking about 10 to the minus 4, so 0.0001 as fraction of the actual light that actually changes,
wow.
as function of wavelength, which you have to observe.
Okay. Yeah. So what kind of molecules have been found so far in exoplanet atmospheres, and how many planets have you managed to sort of cover this technique?
Yeah. So one of the issues is that we need a system to be very bright in the sky to be able to actually do this. We need a lot of photons to be able to actually do these observations. So we can only do a few planets. There are actually, yeah, basically a handful of planets we can do these observations for. And so far, we have been able to see the so-called easy molecules.
Mm-hmm.
That's the molecules that give the strongest absorption in these atmospheres, and that are carbon monoxide and that are water vapor. These are two molecules that you expect to be present in these. These are very hot atmospheres.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You mentioned you need a lot of photons, I mean a lot of light. So what telescopes have you been using to do this?
Almost exclusively we used a very large telescope for this. This is an 8-meter telescope, which is in Chile.
Uh-huh.
We have been lucky to get a lot of observing time to actually do these observations, and we need a lot of observing time. So now we look at stars which you can easily see with your naked eye in the extra sky, and we still need 3 nights of observations to actually get an extra signal out. So
okay. And if you could maybe explain in quite simple terms, how do you actually extract this tiny, tiny signal out of, I mean, I'm assuming there's a whole bunch of stuff that you see, and then you've got to figure out how to extract a small signal.
Yeah, so the real trick what we use here is that we take spectra at very high spectral resolution.
And
what that means is that we measure the wavelength of the light very, very accurately. It's actually in one part in 100,000.
Okay.
And what it means is, the consequence of that is that we can measure, we are sensitive to the velocity of the planet. So if the planet is moving a little bit towards us, then that gives us a shift in wavelength. And actually what happens is when we observe for a whole night is that the velocity of the planet changes because it orbits the actual star.
Sure.
And that means is that these signals, the absorption from the planet, is actually changing in actual wavelength.
Right.
And then, although the planet signal is very weak, all the other parts of the light that we observe do not change in actual wavelength. So we can filter out all the features that we see in the spectrum that do not change in wavelength, and we are left with only the component that actually changes, and that is the exoplanet light.
Oh, wow. So that's really great. That's a very clever way of doing it. So as you mentioned, you've done this with a handful of planets for only a couple of molecules. So what are the future prospects of these kinds of detections?
Yeah. So as you can imagine with the current instruments and telescope, this is very hard work, and we're really at the limit of what we can do. But on the other hand, yeah, we're only scratching the actual surface, right, of what you can know. We can only look at the hottest planets, the brightest planet in the sky. So we really need a larger telescope, and that's where the European Extremely Large Telescope comes into view.
Mm-hmm.
They've sort of started building that now. It should be ready in about 10 years.
Yep.
And then we can start to probe much, much deeper and go to other planets and other molecules.
Yeah, because one of the, I think you also mentioned in your talk, one of the kind of objectives of exoplanet hunters is to find a kind of another Earth, basically, in this sort of habitable zone. So how will the information from these studies actually help us narrow down the search?
Yeah, so what I see, we learn a lot about the physics of these very hot gaseous planets. But of course, one of the reasons why I'm in this field is, within my lifetime, I want to go to these search for these Earth-like planets and see, for example, maybe whether there is oxygen in their atmosphere, which could be a sign of life. This is very difficult for two reasons. One is that these planets but rocky planets like the Earth are much smaller, so they're a factor of 10 smaller in radius. So actually the planet disk is a factor of 100 smaller. And then these atmospheres are much cooler as well, and therefore these atmospheres are much more difficult to observe. And so there's really several orders of magnitude. The observations have to get better by several orders of magnitude. But there is, luckily, there's another road to go on, and that is the signal can be boosted significantly again if you go to stars which are smaller. The Sun is a relatively large star, and actually the majority of stars in the Milky Way is much smaller. These are red dwarf stars. They're much cooler and much smaller. They can be 10 times smaller than the Earth. They radiate 1,000 times less energy. And it also means that you can look for planets with the right temperature much closer to the star.
Uh-huh.
Meaning that would make these kinds of observations hundreds of factors of hundreds easier again. So on one side it's 1,000 times more difficult, but it's also getting then 100 times more easy. So then actually it's not that much more difficult than the kind of observations we do actually now.
Okay, so it kind of balances out, and once you start finding more, like, once you have a nice list of all of these dwarf stars, then potentially something might come up.
Exactly. Yeah.
Excellent. Thank you very much for answering all of our questions, and hopefully we'll see you sometime soon on the podcast.
Thank you.